Well, why don't we just, first of all, just ask the Lord to bless our time together. Father in heaven, thank you for the joy of being able to be here. And we do experience a sense of awe that in your grace that you would have brought such a unique and diverse and different group of people together, all with a common passion to, first of all, to use their lives and their talents and their giftedness to further the cause of the kingdom of God in a variety of unbelievably creative ways that reflect so much of the uniqueness of the body of Christ and the diversity of gifts that you have dispensed to those who have embraced you as their Savior. And we are here, you know, with a passion to serve and to make a difference in our lives and in our work. And we just thank you for the diversity of the body of Christ, the immensity of the body of Christ, and the joy of just meeting new brothers and sisters that we're going to spend eternity with. And so, Lord, we pray that you'd give us a little bit of taste of that, what that's going to be like on earth as it will be in heaven. And we just pray, Lord, that you would guide us in our discussion, that what it is that we say here will be valuable and practical and applicable, so that we can leave here not just understanding what it is we need to do, but knowing how to do it and have the joy of being able to understand that, you know, what it is we're doing really does, when applied, you know, make a difference in enabling us to do what it is you've called us to do. So we just commit this time to you and ask your blessing on it in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we've already kind of alluded to the fact that, you know, this world, you know, we call it development.
Jerry, can I have one question?
Yes.
You never told us what was the thing that you were so good at.
I'm not going to tell you what it is. So.
Interesting book.
Yeah, it's really rather inconsequential, actually. If I were to tell you, you would have said, well, gee, that doesn't make any sense, but it was probably the person that said it who had the right to approach me about something like this. You know, you have to earn that, you know, position where when somebody says something, you really do respond. And who knew me well enough to realize that I had overlooked something that basically he had seen and felt that I was not even taking into consideration in terms of what it is that I do. And like I say, it's, you know, if I were to tell you, you'd say, well, gee, that's kind of like, yeah. But and it's not, you know, that, you know, he saw that I was good in development, but he saw that I had, you know, a gift that basically would enable me to be successful in doing what it is that I was doing, that basically I was depreciating in pursuit of something else that I thought was even more, you know, desirable, at least from my perspective. So. But I ended up, you know, like you are. I mean, nobody, first of all, that enters into this profession, you know, ever planned to. I mean, when you're in the eighth grade, you know, in America, going to school, and you're writing these little papers that you write in the eighth grade, like, what do I want to be when I grow up, you know? Who of you wrote that I want to be a fundraiser? I think it must have been you, Gabriel. I want to be a fundraiser. I mean, I want to do that. Or I want to do, you know, this work of helping organizations develop and become who it is and what it is that, you know, God would have them to be. And none of us did that. I mean, most of us that enter into this profession, I always say, come in through the back door because there is no front door. And, you know, now in America, there are degrees that can be secured by academic institutions where you can get a degree in organizational advancement. And so theoretically, you should be able to go to the door of an organization and say, hey, here I am. You know, I can do what it is that needs to be done to help your organization be able to get where it wants to go. But even with that degree, there's many of them are not as effective as they might be because it's not just what it is that you know, but it's understanding the culture of which you're a part, because the culture of Romania is different than that of Ukraine, which is different than that of Romania and Bulgaria and Norway and all these other places where we find ourselves. And so just having the skills without necessarily being able to relate to people in the kinds of ways that we really want to relate is not guarantee success. So I came in through the back door too. I needed a job. I was going to school. The president came up and said, hey, we've got a job, you know, and we think that you might be a good match for that. And so I said, well, sounds like a pretty good deal. I'll do it. And so the first day on the job, I go to my new boss, and I have a legal pad just like this. And I set up an appointment to meet with him first thing in the morning. And so I go into his office, and I'm sitting down. I'm getting ready to take notes. And the first question I ask him is, well, can you kind of, you know, give me my job description? And because there was never a job description given. It's just like, we have a job for you in the development department. We think you'd be good at it. And so I just figured, well, let me get my job description, because I really would like to know what it is that I'm supposed to do. So I'm getting ready to write, and you know, first of all, he looked really confused, you know, like, what is he really asking me about? And didn't anybody tell him about this? And I'd interviewed with him as well as with the president and other people, but he says, well, he kind of thought about it for a moment, and he says, well, he says, raise money. So I'm writing, and I'm kind of like thinking, well, this is just the beginning of a, you know, a more, you know, complex, diverse job description, you know, that, you know, was going to be very, very descriptive of what it is that I was to do. And he says, do you have any other questions? And I said, well, how much? And he says, a lot. And I walked out with, you know, four words on the legal pad. Because that's, he says, do you have any other questions? I said, well, I guess not. And I walked out, you know, 3 minutes after I walked in, and I'm thinking, you know, here's my job description, raise a lot of money. Now, who in this room knows what a lot of money is? Give me a number. What's a lot of money? I mean, and you'd say, well, a gazillion dollars is a lot of money. Well, then $2 gazillion is more money, right? I mean, so, I mean, what's a lot of money? You know, I've raised what, in my estimation, is, in the course of my career, a lot of money. But, you know, there's other people that raised more money than I've ever raised. And so how much is a lot? I thought we were getting close one day when the president came down to our office 4 or 5 years later, and he walked into our office, and he gathered all of the employees that worked in the development department together, and he just said, you know, this has been a great year. We've raised more money than we've ever raised in the history of the institution. It's been incredible. You guys have done a great job. We raised a lot of money. He used the word a lot of money. And I'm thinking, okay, now how much is a lot? And I knew that that year was like $2.5 million. I'm thinking $2.5 million is a lot of money. And so he gave everybody a pat on the back. And then he walked out. He says, Jerry, will you come with me? And so I was walking with him, you know, to the door, and he put his arm on my shoulder. He says, you know, good job, and kind of a pat on the back, you know, kind of a thing. And then he gave me a sheet of paper, and it was the goal for next year, which is like $3 million. And I'm thinking, well, gee, I thought $2.5 million was a lot. And he says, well, it never goes down. I mean, every year somebody's going to say, well, you need to raise more money than you raised the year before. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking, is there any place, I mean, do I ever reach this goal? Do I ever find the kind of fulfillment that I really need to have in order to stay in this profession? And honestly, you know, tenure in this profession is like 1.8 years. Isn't that comforting for those of you that are just getting started? You know, okay, I've got 1.76 left, you know, or whatever. In other words, you know, people just don't stay in the profession that long. Yes.
But tenure by definition means that you will still have a job without being fired.
Well, yeah, I'm using tenure in a different word. I mean, you know, this is the duration, but you're right. I mean, the realities are that most people by 1.8 years are just out of here. And it wasn't because they were incompetent. It wasn't because they weren't skilled. It wasn't because they didn't have the ability or the personality or everything that would be needed to be successful in the organization. It's because they didn't have a clue what to do. And if what you're doing is basically measured in terms of the physical year of your organization, in other words, okay, this is the beginning of the year, this is the end of the year, and by the end of the year we have to have so much money or we're not going to be around next year. And so if that's the way you're measuring success, then it becomes, you know, you're on a treadmill that you can't get off. And you're saying, I'm not sure that I'm finding what it is that I'm supposed to be finding here. And I think there's probably easier ways to make a living than the way I'm making it. And I'm just not sure that this is a place I'm supposed to be. And so somehow I had to figure that out, because I I just had to understand and know what it is that I was doing was making a difference. And it wasn't just all measured in terms of money. And so I had to figure that out. And so I think, you know, I have been on a 40-year journey or so trying to figure this out. And I think I've discovered answers that have allowed me the opportunity of not only to be in this ministry and this organization and being in this work, but also finding an incredible amount of fulfillment of knowing that, you know, I have contributed in helping make a difference to many organizations. And you need to have that. If you don't have that assurance, then you won't stay very long. And the landscape of development is covered with the bodies of the fallen. I mean, it's like the beaches. Yeah, it's like the beaches of Normandy. You're just kind of crawling over bodies looking for one that's alive, you know, so that you can kind of pick him up and put him into the development office, you know, and then, you know, let him stay for another year or so until he falls. And so the realities are, you know, that's the way I came into the profession. That's the way most of you came in. I mean, people just said, you know, you need to raise money. You say, well, how in the world am I going to do that? I don't know anything about raising money. Do you know I'm a doctor? You know, that's the reason that I became a doctor, because I didn't want to have to raise money. I wanted to make money. You know, or whatever the case might be. So,
Jerry, aren't development people sort of like salespeople that you kind of have a question mark about?
Oh yeah.
You know, they're not. You know, there's something. You know, they're not to the work.
Yeah.
Not at
yeah.
the level. They've got the plaid coat and the.
Oh yeah, well I never occasionally people will introduce me and they'll say, well, here's Jerry, he's a fundraiser. That's like the worst introduction you could ever get, you know, because you know what the immediate thing that happens is that people step back.
For their wallet.
Yeah, they cut back. They step back two paces as they look for their wallet or they cover their purse, you know, and they expect that you all look like you know fundraisers have this vision that they have shiny pants and cowboy boots in America. You know, that's they have these shiny pants and cowboy boots and they're out to get your money and they're slick, you know, they're car salesmen. I mean, you get it. I mean, it's not really comforting at all. I've never seen myself as a fundraiser, and I really don't. I've helped raise organizations raise, you know, well over, you know, almost $2 billion, I think, is by last count. And the reality is I've never seen myself as a fundraiser. Development includes, and let me just tell you what development includes, and we're going to be talking about all of these issues. So you need to understand that development is not fundraising. I mean, fundraising is just something that we do. We have to raise money, and that's part of our job, and we understand that. But development or fundraising's success is going to be measured and predicated on how well we do a lot of other things. Because it doesn't stand by itself, and it never has stand by itself, and it can't stand by itself on its own and be successful in the long term. So the six things that make up the developmental function, let's just make some notes. And basically notes, so don't be alarmed. You're going to get all of that and more, I promise you. And then I'll make available to you a book it's online and I can send to you, and you can print it out, which will cover this, what we're discussing, and much more. So we'll give you everything that you need in order to be able to, I think, be successful in what it is that God's called you to do.
Is that a free book?
Of course it's free.
No, there is a bookstore.
Well, no, there is a book up there that I've written that I think it's in the bookstore that isn't free, but it's free to the forum. I just gave them to the forum, so I don't make any money. Yeah. I guess, yeah, it's a donation.
No, I'm just trying to show that Jerry will offer you free information resources free of charge.
Yeah, I haven't figured. The reason that I don't have any money is because I
give it away
everywhere. But I've discovered that in the economy of God that he operates on a totally different economic system.
Yeah, right.
I mean, so anyway, but I'll give you whatever you need. So here are the six areas of development. Fundraising, that's one of them, okay? We do have a responsibility. We do want to engage people in a variety of different ways to participate financially in the support of our organizations. So fundraising is kind of like important. It's a part of what it is we do. A second thing that we do is we recruit and we want to retain people. In other words, we're recruiting volunteers, we're recruiting partners, we're recruiting people that will assist us, employees, board members, you know, we're constantly in this mode of engaging people and trying to get more people involved in what it is we're doing, and that's called recruitment. And then the other end of recruitment is retention, and that is making sure that we keep them. And so maintaining a record of attrition and retention percentages is very, very important. In other words, at some point in time in the materials and the programs that, you know, Victor is developing, you know, we'd like to get a report at the end of the year, you know, how many donors that gave in 2010, you know, how many of them continued in their long-term support of the organization? What was our retention percentage? Or what was our attrition percentage of volunteers, of donors, of friends, of board members, et cetera? Because the goal is not just to get somebody in, but we want to keep them there. Because if we're not bringing, you know, if people are coming in, you know, 1 year through the front door and then they're leaving through the back door and we're constantly trying to fill up the room, but the room is never full because, you know, they're running out the back door as quick as they're coming into the front door, then we're not going to be successful. And usually when people leave, which is always, you know, the primary reason why they leave is unrealized expectations. They became involved in your organization because they had expectations. And maybe their expectations weren't realistic to begin with. That's beside the point. Their expectations weren't realized. And so they leave with a negative feeling because they were thinking they were going to experience something that they never did experience. And so they leave. And unfortunately, the average dissatisfied customer, you know, shares his dissatisfaction with about 15 people. You know, the average satisfied customer shares it with about 3 or 4. I mean, so it's a losing game. I mean, after, you know, attrition can get so high that there's not a chance, you know, practically speaking, to be successful. And so then we go to new markets and basically spoil them in the same way we did our old markets. So, you know, you can't, you know, remove the whole importance of the recruitment retention component of development. A third area is public relations. You know, people have an image of your organization. And if you really want to do something humbling, you know, go to a total stranger and ask them about your organization or somebody that has some familiarity with it and ask them, what is this? If you were writing the mission statement of this organization, you know, how would you write it? What do you see them doing? And it can be a very humbling exercise because, you know, the people that you think know the most about you don't have a clue what you do. They have an idea of some of the things that you do, but they don't really understand why you're doing it or all the things that are behind it. They're just kind of like, yeah, well, this is what they do. Well, you say, no, this isn't what we do. But usually we live with that. You know, we just kind of feel bad about it. You know, isn't that too bad that everybody thinks that? And so, you know, the typical response is to be, you know, reactive. You know, well, we'll just try to, you know, make that right with one particular person, or we'll try to, you know, clarify all of this and so that we hopefully won't have to deal with this again. And you know, it keeps coming up and up. And we just need to be more proactive public relationally. And we're going to be talking more about that. You know, and it usually starts with, what do you want people to say about you? What do you want them to, you know, think about you? What do you want them to, how do you want them to respond when asked the question, well, who is this organization? What it is that they do? And one of the things that we do with a lot of our clients is we do what we call public relations audits. It's really pretty interesting. You know, we gather all the material that an organization has about itself, and we hand it to people that don't even know about the organization, and we hand it to them and we say, okay, we're going to give you an hour to look all over this, and then we'd like you to tell us about the organization, what it is that they do. You want to? And that's almost as humbling as asking somebody about. I mean, because, I mean, here's the best of what you have to offer. All the materials, everything that you have to offer, you just give them to everybody. And we put them together in a packet, and we take them to total strangers that have nothing to gain. I mean, you're not, I mean, basically, there are people that are smart, that are intelligent, and we're giving them to people who, and we're just saying, we'd like you to look at this, and then we'd like you to write to us to tell us about what this organization, that we have a series of questions that we want them to answer. And it can be one of the most revealing exercises that you'll ever become involved in.
CEO will let you do that because it's going to reflect.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we just say this is what you need to do, and you know, the board doesn't, the CEO doesn't really like it. Usually, we're administered by the board. You know, the board says this is what we want to do, and we tell them that this is what you need to do. You need to find out where you are before you can change anything. You got to somehow get down to the foundation before you can start building. And so, and a perception, you know, public relations is just really pretty important. Then the fourth area. This is the one that everybody gets really excited about, and as soon as I say it, you're going to start jiggling in your seat with excitement, you know, database management. Doesn't that really get you excited? You know, I'm hoping that he was talking about that. But, you know, the realities are we maintain data on people with whom we're building a relationship. And we put them into a, now we can put it into a computer program. Victor is trying to do that for us. And we want to support him. Maybe he'll make us all beta users. We can try to, you know, try this out on our own, and we won't have to pay an awful lot for it. But the realities are, you know, you need to know where people... You see, the biggest mistake we make in development, you know what it is? It's the assumption that everybody in our database is in the same relationship to the organization as the person next to them in line, alphabetically. Okay, so just imagine Mr. Turner is on the database. He's right there. Mr. Turner, you could get a lot of information by going to his record. You could learn a lot about Mr. Turner. Now, right behind Mr. Turner in the database is Mr. Twombly, T-U-T-W. And so here's Mr. Twombly, and he's right there too. And we assume by default that Mr. Turner and Mr. Twombly are exactly the same. They have the same relationship with the organization as... You know, they both share that same understanding, that same passion, that same commitment, that same love, that same awareness of what it is this organization does. And you say, well, that's not true. I mean, they're not the same. I mean, Mr. Turner, and then somebody that knows Mr. Turner says, yeah, we picked up his name from a check that was written to buy a book, you know, that he sent in to us, and we put the name into the database. That's how we got there. Mr. Turner bought a book. Well, Mr. Twombly's been a founding member of the board. He's been a major donor. He's a volunteer. He comes to group meetings. He leads things. I mean, they're not the same, but we treat them the same. They get the same piece of mail. They get the same literature. They get the same. And we assume, you know, and I always tell people, you know, in America, when we're talking about, you know, percentages of response, you know, to appeals, if you're sending a letter, you know, appealing for funds or whatever, you know, the average response rate for direct response mail is about 3%.
Now, is that dropped off in each year?
Well, it is, and it's going down.
It is going down.
Yeah, it is going down for a lot of reasons, which we'll explain in the context of this session. So it's going down. Now, and sometimes we send out a letter and we get a 4% response or a 5% response, and people are like, you know, dancing in the streets. I mean, like, whoa, 5% response, yeah. And they're high-fiving everybody. And, I mean, this is just like the greatest day ever, you know. And you say, are you satisfied with the fact that 95% of the people that you sent this information to could care less about your organization? Well, I didn't look at it that way. I mean, like, if 5% responded, which is really considered good, that means 95% didn't give a rip about what it is that you just sent them. They just couldn't care less.
Internet, it's 1-2 people to 1,000.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, that's 0.1%. We're talking about the 6 things that make up development. We're kind of honing in a little bit on database management. And if it does really become a, you know, such an important part of development is really how we manage information. I had been doing development for a number of years, and I was appointed vice president for advancement of our small college and university. And so I just took, you know, over from somebody else. And I was working in the department, so it was the same department I'd been involved in for a number of years. But I wasn't sure all the things that were being done, and reports would periodically come in, and I'd just turn them over to somebody, and, you know, assuming that, you know, some of these things were relevant and important for somebody to fill out, but I wasn't really the person to do that. So they would just fill out these forms. Well, about 4 years later, I discovered that we were participating in a study that was being done on a national basis that was being coordinated by the Council for the Advancement and Support of Education, which is an organization that represents higher educational institutions in America. In conjunction with the Chronicle Philanthropy, which is an organization that basically serves the philanthropic community in the United States. And we got a call, and we were, it was announced that we were winners in a certain category as a model for small college development programs, which, you know, was totally unexpected because we really didn't even know we were competing with anybody about anything. We were just filling out forms, and all of a sudden we get this award, and people are coming and taking pictures, and it got a lot of national publicity because of the organizations that were sponsoring this. And all of a sudden, I started getting phone calls, and people were saying, well, because they used the word, you were a model for small college development programs. So somebody said, you know, and the name of our college was Grace College and Theological Seminary, and so they said, I'd get these phone calls and said, will you come and talk about the Grace model to our organization? And I'm thinking, I'm finally walking around the office, and I'm saying, do we have a model? Because I wasn't really certain that we had a model. We were just kind of doing things like you do things. You know, things that worked, we kind of emphasized, and things that didn't work, we either eliminated or changed them or shifted the things around. But what happened was interesting. That was a four-year period of time where giving went from $475,000 a year, which was what was occurring, you know, early in this process. And 4 years later, we were generating around $2.5 to $3 million a year. And so that was fairly significant, and at least caught their attention. But the thing that really resulted in the award was the fact that that increase in giving occurred without an appreciable increase in the size of the database. In other words, the same people that were giving $475,000 four years later were giving $2.5 million or $3 million, and that was what really caught their attention. And essentially, that was really quite intentional, because I had come to the conclusion when I took the job as the vice president for advancement that one of the things that I did was I got all of the database, you know, reports, and that was back in the days, you can remember, the big green sheets of paper, you know, with the holes in them, and I took them home one day and I stuck it next to my lazy boy. And for about a week or two, I just went through every single name on those 45,000 names. And I didn't know, you know, the majority of them, obviously. But there was enough fields of information that I could see who they were and the relationship they had with the institution. And if they were donors and not donors, whether they were alumni or non-alumni or parents of students or whatever the case might be. But I kind of looked through this list, and I concluded after looking through it all that probably we had everything that we needed in order to be successful in that database. And so rather than expand the database, which would be another approach to development, you know, increasing the number of people in your database, which is something that we need to be thinking about, obviously. But rather than focus there, I wanted to focus on, let's kind of look at the database and see if we can fine-tune it better to identify where people are in relationship to the organization. And there was one period of time where we sent out a direct response marketing piece, and we got an 80% response instead of a 3% response. But we didn't send it to everybody on the list, obviously. We sent it to people on the list that we knew were going to respond because of what we knew about them that we didn't know before. And that's why database management is so important. So what the project that Victor's working on, if he gets it right, it could literally change the world of philanthropy for organizations like yours. And that's why...
I'm sorry. Is it culturally... the same? I mean, could we use it in all cultures?
Yes, I think so. Yes. And because the model for development that I basically are going to be talking to you about is what we call relational development.
Right.
In other words, I define development this way. So if you want to write down something that's important, this is the definition of development. We'll come back and circle back and talk about the other two parts of the developmental process in just a few moments, or the things that make up development. But development, I define development this way. It's the things that we do, because we're doing things all the time. It's the things that we do within our organization to build what I call rational relationships with others. The thing that makes this an incredibly fun, enjoyable, satisfying, fulfilling job is the fact that you're building relationships. And it seems to me that, you know, the Bible is a story about relationships. It's a story about a relationship that was severed in the Garden of Eden. And basically, it's the story of how God chose to restore that relationship through Jesus Christ on Calvary. And it's all about relationships. And development, you know, is all about relationships. It's not about fundraising. It's about relationships. And it really has very little to do with fundraising. Development is all about relationships. It doesn't have an awful lot to do with what you have to say. I'll speak at a lot of conferences all year long in different places around the world, and I speak to a lot of pastors' conferences, and you know, those are, you know, that's a pretty tough group sometimes to talk to if you're not a theologian, and I don't perceive myself as being a theologian. And so I make the statement that development is all about relationships, and it has very little to do with what you have to say. And if you really want to get a bunch of pastors agitated, that will, you know, that pretty much does it most every time. And I said, but before you, you know, condemn me for making that statement, let me make another one. To the degree that you're successful in building relationships, you won't lack for money, nor will you lack for someone who will want to respond and desire to respond to what it is you have to say. And that's true. I mean, if we were sitting around this room and I said, okay, let's talk about our walk with, you know, our faith walk. And tell me your story. And you're going to tell me your story. But that story is just filled with people, isn't it? You know, in my case, it was like mom and dad, you know, and what I experienced from them. Then there was a scout leader that really had an incredible impact on my life. And as I participated in, you know, the kinds of things that, you know, boys do in America as they're growing up. And then I had a couple of coaches in athletics that saw that I had some ability, but basically that ability was hampered by my sense of competitiveness. I was extremely competitive to the point where I would almost rationally lose things, and I'd get angry, and then I became ineffective. But there were coaches that saw all of that. There were Christians and helped me to deal with that. And all. But it's a story of people. All of our lives are stories of people. And it's people that earn the right to speak into our lives. Because of who it is they were and the role that they played with us, they earned the right to be able to speak into our lives in meaningful ways that has facilitated change. So it's all about relationships. And you know, I've been accused of a lot of things over the years. You know, we get accused, you know, if you ever speak to a group of people, then you're going to be critiqued, you know, and if you speak to a lot of people, you're going to be critiqued a lot. And so I've been critiqued a lot. And some people have said to me, and this is the thing, if you wanted to say something that would really hurt Jerry in a very, very significant way, this is what you would say. Jerry, you are nothing more than a master manipulator. And that's like putting a sword in my soul and then just twisting it a little bit, making sure that, you know, our physician friend can't do anything about the damage that just was caused by the piercing of my soul. I mean, the realities are, you know, that's not what I want to be, and that's not what you want to be. And the reason why you don't like development or you don't like fundraising is because you feel like you're being that way, don't you? You feel like you're manipulating people to do what it is that they may not want to do. And so, you know, there's nothing fun about that. There's a passage of God's Word that I've memorized, and I suspect most of you have. If you're in the development office, you probably, assuredly, will memorize it at some point in time. And it's the passage in James chapter 2 where James, the brother of Jesus, says, "Do not hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism. If a person comes into your assembly dressed in fine clothes and a big gold ring," You know the story, don't you? And there also comes in a poor man dressed in dirty clothes who probably smells and is not nearly as appealing as the rich man with the nice clothes and the gold ring. And you say to the one dressed in the fine clothes, "Why don't you sit down here in this good place?" So they have a prominent place for him to seat, acknowledging the fact that he has the riches that they think they need in order to be able to be successful in what it is that they're doing. But you say to the poor man, "Why don't you sit back there in the back of the room? There's a good place back there. In fact, why don't you just sit underneath that chair over there? That would be a better place for you." And then James says, "Have you not made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil motives?" And let me just tell you something, because I'm going to give you another very objective way of being able to objectively assess whether or not you've been manipulative or not. And it's a sure way of being able to determine that. I mean, it's just like, if you've done this, then you probably have been. And I think it's important for us to do that. It's a fine line in the sand. I'll admit to that. And I'm not always sure that I understand all of that. But if you're pursuing people for just what it is you can get from them in terms of money, you probably have been manipulative. And you probably have every right to be as uncomfortable as some of us are and some of us have been as it relates to asking people for money. So the point is, always lead with a relationship. And when you try to circumvent the relationship to meet a need, in other words, over here, we've got this financial need, and so I'm going to just jump over relationships to go to this, to get this need met, then you probably have been manipulative. In other words, now you're looking at a person for what it is that they can give to you without understanding and realizing that they are a person with the same kinds of feelings and concerns, frustrations and anxieties and anticipations and goals that you have. So always lead with your, with the relationship. Now, yes, Arnold.
Is there any limit to the number of relationships that an organization can develop?
No. There's... No, I really don't think so. I think, and that's really where the developmental process comes in place. I mean, there's a number of relationships that I can effectively personally manage myself. But I think as an organization, if we really organize ourselves well, I think there's the capacity of being able to really have meaningful relationships with the majority of people that basically we're working with.
Does a development relationship mean that there are two human beings on both sides of the relationship? That is the development department a department of relational people?
Now, that's a good question. I'm not sure I know how to answer that question. Let me say that I've worked with lots of clients. Some are really very, very large, and some are, you know, obviously, you know, smaller organizations like those that you represent. But one of our clients is Habitat for Humanity, which is a big organization in America. It's one of the largest charities in America. They have 15 million people on their database. 15, I mean, not 15,000, 15 million people on their database. Now, how do you build relationships with 15 million people?
Yeah, right.
I mean, and that's the question. It's a legitimate question. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, these people have a person within the organization that they know and they're in relationship with in the ways that you just described it. But I think that they do feel a kinship to Habitat for Humanity as an organization because of the way that the organization has engaged them, which may or may not have involved the person. But in most instances, it involved the person, but not necessarily one that they would you know, have for dinner on Thursday afternoon or whatever the case might be. But the point is that it is possible, and it basically the possibility is enhanced by the ability of software like what Victor is attempting to produce that basically allows us to understand where people are in relationship to the organization and what proactively we're doing to move them into a different type of a relationship. And so that's the data process. Now, when we talk about relationships, you know, there's all kinds of words that you could use to define a great relationship. I mean, if I were to ask you, you know, what are the, you know, think about the person that you're closest to in life, and it may be your spouse or maybe just, you know, somebody you grew up with. I mean, I have some guys that I grew up with that we've been friends for 60 years, you know, and we're just like the best of friends. I just went to my 50th college reunion about a month or two ago, and I really didn't want to go. I got this invitation. I said to my wife, I don't think I want to go to that. And she said, why wouldn't you want to go? I said, there's just going to be a bunch of old people there, you know. And I'm like, I'm thinking that they're old, but I'm not, you know. I just never age, but they did. And it's really sad to see these people get old and decrepit. But I went, and it was a wonderful experience. And here are people that I knew 50 years ago, and we went to college together. We had great experiences, but, you know, these people, it was just wonderful. And I think of all the things that I would use, all the words that I would use to describe them. They were fun. We shared a lot of the same interests. You know, we kind of continued conversations that we began 50 years ago. We left 50 years ago. We just kind of kept on with the process. It was a very, very delightful time. But the defining characteristic of a relationship is that it's reciprocal. Okay? In other words, both parties benefit from a relationship. And if both parties don't benefit from the relationship, you don't have a relationship. What you have is an arrangement. And there's a difference. In other words, if both parties don't benefit from the relationship, you don't have a relationship. What you have is an arrangement. And we have a lot of arrangements with donors, don't we? If you send us money, we're going to send you newsletters. We're going to really treat you nice. You're going to get all kinds of stuff from us. And, you know, we're going to maybe even send you a Christmas gift or a Christmas card or something like that. But if you stop giving, you're not going to hear from us anymore. And that's essentially an arrangement. As long as you give and perform the way we expect you to do that, then everything's going to be okay. But if you don't perform appropriately, then things are not going to be, you know, just right for us. So it's reciprocal. And so you need to ask yourself the question, you know, as you're thinking about development on a macro scale here is, you know, what ways do people that support our organizations benefit from their support from us, or what, how do they benefit in their relationship with us? And that becomes a little bit harder question to answer, doesn't it? Because it really is an important question. Now, the second part of that definition, because remember, it's the things that we do to build rational relationships with people, that there's a quality of relationship that we're talking about, and it's what I call rational, which is to be differentiated from emotional. In other words, it's a substantive relationship. It's built upon something that's solid, that's objective, that's, you know, credible. And the best way to describe this is that the greatest analogy of development, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about this tomorrow and maybe even this morning, although I don't think we'll get to it today. Probably tomorrow morning we'll talk about it. But the greatest analogy of development, I mean, if you're looking for an example, I always tell people, you know, development is easy. I mean, like, this is the easiest thing ever. I mean, really. I mean, we all think it's complicated. I came here because I'm going to try to unravel this mystery of, you know, how do you do development, you know? And I think Jerry's going to be able to help me unravel the mystery because he's really smart. Let me tell you, it's simple. And it's so simple that it's almost ridiculously simple. And you know what? All of you have experience. That's the thing. You have experience in doing this. This is like easy. And when I say that, people say, come on, you got to be kidding. And I said, no, this is the easiest thing ever. Because the greatest analogy of development is falling in love. Now, who in this room hasn't fallen in love? You know, with someone or with something or whatever. I mean, we've all experienced falling in love, and it's great, isn't it? It was just terrific. And stop and think about it for a moment, and think how strange this is. How many of you are married? Raise your hand if you're married. Okay. And for those of you that are married, the doctor's not married. Okay. Well, now I've got a couple of people I want to introduce you to. No. Yeah, I have a daughter, you know. No, I don't really. Okay, so for those of you that are married, I'm going to ask you a question, okay. From the time that you, okay, saw the person that you eventually married for the first time, I mean, and some of this is going to be, you know, for some of you, well, like, I knew her back when we were in grade school. Well, yeah, but you weren't thinking about her as a wife at grade. But, you know, when you finally saw that this is a person that basically, you know, you kind of looked at her in a different way and, you know, whatever, or him in a different way. So from the time that you saw this person, and in some instances it may be the first time, to the time that you stood in front of a pastor, and you looked her in the eye and you said, for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, until what? Until death separate us? I mean, that's like a big decision, right? I mean, like, we're not talking about, you know, hey, let's just, you know, be buddies, you know, for the rest of our lives. I mean, we're just saying, you know, this is it. I mean, this is, I'm committing my life to you. Now, from the time that you met this person for the first time until the time that you stood in front of a pastor, how long was it?
6.5 years.
6.5 years for you. How long was it?
2 years.
2 years.
Till death.
Huh?
Till death.
2 months? Wow.
They have 3 girls, and we are very, very, very good family.
Oh, I am sure.
But we start to understand what does mean love after 10 years.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, there's more to this story. Okay, all right, 2 months. That may be the new record. Okay, well, no, actually, I've had one earlier than more than that. Yeah. Time.
Me?
Yeah.
I'm not married.
Oh, you're not married. Well, my golly, that's, we can't let that be.
There's a doctor over here.
Yeah.
A little over 2 years.
2 years. Okay. How long, Patricia? 2 years. We know it's six. How many?
Two.
One and a half.
Not married.
Not married. Okay, well, look at this opportunity here. Okay, now.
For development. The doctor in your head.
Well, for me, it was like 9 months, you know, so, or 10 months. So, what in the world happened that would cause you, in a period of 2 years or 6 months or 2 months, to commit your life to another person for the rest of your life? And literally, if you can walk back through that process, which is really easy to do. I mean, I'm going to walk you through it tomorrow. I mean, this is what happened here, and this is what happened here, and you say, yeah, that's what happened. And then this happened, and you say, yeah, that happened too. And then this happened, and this happened. Yes, that's exactly what happened. And maybe it was longer, maybe it was shorter, but it happened in every one of our experiences to the point that we were prepared to do that without any reservation whatsoever. And if you understand that process, then you understand development. That's how easy it is. Because all we're doing is we're replicating the process. We're going to go through the same process. We're going to replicate that process in kinds of terms that we all can understand, we all can relate to. And it is really, really easy. Now, the thing that you need to remember is that it's emotion that brings us together. That's the first thing you need to remember. People are emotional people. And it's whether it's with an organization, like a hospital idea, we want to do these hospitals, you know, where we're going to be different kinds of hospitals that kind of serve in the kinds of ways that would be compatible with our commitment to Jesus Christ. You know, so, but that's a very emotional thing. You know, it's emotion that brings us together. The organizations that we support, think of all the organizations maybe that you support financially. I mean, you would have a story with every one of them that says why you became involved. And it's an emotional story. It's emotion that brings us together into relationship, but it's rationalism that keeps us there. Emotion is fleeting. You know, you ever been angry about something? And just, I mean, to the point where you just kind of just lost it. You're just so angry about something. And then about 6 months later, somebody says, well, do you remember when you were angry? And I said, I'm not sure I remember that. Really? I was really, you know, or whatever. I mean, it's just kind of like you know, emotion is fleeting. So the realities are, and you know, the greatest illustration, I'm going to tell you the story about my mom and dad, because I think it's just a great illustration. Because my mother passed away about 7 years ago, and she died about 6 weeks before their 70th wedding anniversary. So they were married for 69 years, so almost 70 years. My dad's still alive. He's 98 years old. He lives up in Maine.
You're never going to retire.
No, I'm never going to retire. He's funny. He's really a character. I love my dad, and I have such deep respect for my dad. You know, the greatest gift that a dad can give his children is to love their mother, and my dad loved my mother. And so I just have an immense amount of respect for my dad. But he is getting kind of funny. He lives in an assisted living area. He'd like you to remind you of that. He doesn't need to be there. He just, you know, but I'm here because sometimes I fall, you know, so he kind of, but he's quite a character. But I was with him the other day, and whenever an old person says the other day, that could be 3 years ago. Except unless they're a woman. My wife can say the other day, and she could be referring to something that happened 20 years ago. And I'm thinking, well, I thought that was over. But I was with my dad about a month or two ago, and there was a young man that worked with my dad on his fishing boat. And he was like a teenager, you know, like 14 or 15 years old when he started working with my dad. And he would be what's called a baitman. He would, you know, bait the lobster traps and so forth. So it's a nasty job, but, you know, somebody has to do it. Usually it's 14-year-old kids who are looking to earn some money. So this kid helped. And my dad, I always called him Big Mike. And he wasn't really a big kid, but he just liked to call him Big Mike for some reason. And Big Mike lived down the road, and his parents were wonderful people. His dad was a doctor, and his mom was a teacher, and just a wonderful family. And so Big Mike, you know, when my dad retired from his business, when he finally had to give up lobstering, he just gave his boat and his lobster traps and everything that he had, he gave it to Big Mike. You know, he's like a 15-year-old kid, you know, he's now lobstering in Maine. And because, you know, my dad just liked him. And, you know, there's no sense to give this fishing boat to Jerry. You know, what's he going to do with it? he gets sick. It's a real mess when he goes out there. So anyway, I met with my dad, and my dad is, Big Mike walks in. Now, Big Mike now is like 17 or 18 years old, and he's got this idea of how he's going to change the lobster industry in Maine. And he's just a kid with an entrepreneurial mind. He's got this thing all figured out, And he comes into my dad and he shares this idea. And my dad just looks at him and says, "That's stupid." That's all he said. "That's stupid." I'm sitting there listening. And poor Big Mike, you could see the countenance really drain, oh man, because he loves my dad. He just has such great respect for my dad. And my dad just kind of, dissed his idea, says this is really has absolutely no relevance whatsoever. And so Big Mike is trying to, kind of control himself a little bit and try to get control of the conversation. And then finally, he says, "Well, no, I need to go home." And he gives my dad a hug and he leaves. And my dad says, "Oh, I'll see you, Big Mike," and so forth. And so after he leaves, I look at my dad. I says, "Dad, there are probably six ways you could have handled that differently that would have been much more appropriate." He says, "Oh, I know." He says, "I just don't have time." He says, "You have to understand, when you're 98 years old and somebody asks you your opinion, you better get it out quick because you don't know when you're going to drop dead." So my dad's a real character. But anyway, I have to tell you about my mom and dad. My mother had Alzheimer's disease. And I think that would be a term that would be familiar to most of you. And for 10 years, she did not know anyone in our family. She didn't know me. She didn't know my sister. She didn't know my dad. She didn't recognize any. The worst day of my life was the day that I walked up to see my mother. She was still ambulatory. She was still walking. And the worst day of my life was when she walked right past me. Didn't even know who I was. And I just remember going down and just sobbing in my car, as I sat in the parking lot, because I realized that I'd never see her and experience her as I experienced her as a child. But my dad, for 10 years, most Alzheimer's patients don't die of Alzheimer's disease. Do you know that most Alzheimer's patients die from malnutrition? Because they stop eating. And my dad somehow knew that, and he wouldn't, he refused to let my mother die from malnutrition. So every day for 10 years, every single day for 10 years, he would go to the nursing home at lunchtime. And the people in the nursing home just loved my dad, because usually when people have an Alzheimer's victim, who has lost total awareness of anybody that was important to them in their lives, they just kind of drop them off and pick them up when they die, because why would you go see somebody that doesn't even know who you are, But my dad every single day would go. And the nurses loved him because they would pull out my mother, at the end she was kind of semi-comatose, and they would bring her out they'd roll out her bed to a little private place at the end of a corridor or whatever, and my dad would just go. And I hated to go to Maine to see my dad. I just really did. I mean, this is something I had to take 3 months to prepare for, and then 3 months to get over it after I left, I mean, it was awful. I just didn't want to do that. And I loved to see my dad, but I just hated to see my mom. The last day I saw my mother, I'd fly up to Maine, and my dad, comes around, 11:30, and he's starting to get ready, and I'm thinking, oh, I got to do this. And so finally he says, "Okay, let's go up to the nursing home." And I said, "Okay." So we get in the car, and he's driving, and I don't really say much of anything, because I just, I'm just trying to get the strength to get through this, So we get there. And I walk over and my mother doesn't even open her eyes, and I kiss her and whisper something in her ear or whatever. And my dad then goes over and he puts his arm around her and he pulls her close. And he had one of these handy wipes, he just would wipe the drainage from her eyes. And then he had some chapstick, and he'd put the chapstick on her lips because her lips would get really dry in the hospital. And he'd whisper to her and hug her and say, "Well, honey, I love you, and I'm here, and we're going to get some good, great dinner." And then he'd put her head gently down. She didn't even open her eyes. I mean, she just, so he goes and gets the food, which is just all blender food, okay? The only way you know that something is fish is that it looks like wallpaper paste, okay? Peas look like green, okay? I mean, it's just all, like baby food, And the first thing he does is he tastes it to see whether it's too hot or too cold. And then, the next thing he does is he puts salt all over it. It's a kind of a tradition in our family. We're kind of really salt consumers, you know. And for those of you that are concerned about my blood pressure, it's like 114 over 60 or something. I mean, if I didn't eat salt, I'd die. And so in our family, it was, you know, after amen, you know, thank the Lord for the food, amen, it was pass the salt, please. And just, you know, you don't even check it to see if it needs salt. You just kind of put salt on it. So, and then my mother was that way. And so he just put salt on everything. And then he goes over and he feeds her. And every time he puts a spoon in her mouth, she spits out the food. He just puts it back again. He puts it out. He puts it back again, you know. He just does this every single day and then gives her a drink. And he's talking to her the entire time, just chatting away, you know. And, of course, her eyes not even open. And then, you know, I'm sitting there just watching, you know. And this was what my sisters would do, the same thing, you know, because we, you know, he just knew this routine. Well, then he finishes and he wipes her face and then he sits down by the bed and he holds her hand. He says, well, honey, you know, and he's just talking about the day. And he says, well, you know, Jerry's here. You know, Jerry needs a little special attention because you know Jerry, you know. And, you know, and then there's a, you know, a prayer need. Something came up, you know, like one of my sister's sons was having a problem. He says, you know, Stevie's having a little bit of problem. So I think we got to pray about that right now. So he just starts praying, you know. And she's just laying there. Doesn't even open her eyes. And then, you know, he's getting ready to leave and he just pulls her close again. He says, honey, I love you. And, you know, for a kid, it's still embarrassing. You know, I'm still his kid. I'm, you know, I'm just kind of, come on, Dad. You know, like, hey, you know. 70 years of marriage, you know. He just holds her and he kisses her. Kiss. He says, I'll see you tomorrow, sweetie. And then, you know, we leave. And I get in the car and I'm a basket case. I mean, literally. I mean, I am a total basket case. I'm just totally, you know, I can't deal with this, you know. I get in the car. I sit down. And he's driving. Now, he's 90-some years old by this time, you know, and, like, you know, talk to a guy that's 90 years old to drive. Because when my dad would, you know, oh, I'm glad you asked that. So I didn't say anything, but I couldn't say anything because I was just so emotionally drained by this experience. And we drive up. We have a long driveway that goes to our house. It's like a half mile long. And about halfway up the driveway, I said, you know, Dad, I have no idea how you do this. That's all I said. Now, in America, we have a term that refers to fishermen. They're called old salts. If you look up old salt in Google, there's a picture of my dad, you know. I mean, he has skin you couldn't cut with a chainsaw. I mean, literally. I mean, he'd have this, you know, on the ocean, water flowing up in his face and the wind blowing, you know. And he's just got like a leather, you know. And he's just really a small man, but yet just, you know, really hardy. And he never says anything until we get to the end of the driveway. He stops the car. He turns it off. He opens the door. And then he looks over to me and he says, you know, he says, 70 years ago, I stood in front of your mother in your grandmother's living room. The tear runs down his eye. He says, she was just so beautiful. And I looked at her that day. And I said, for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse. In sickness and in health, until death do us part. And then he gets out of the car. Well, like now I'm a real basket case. I mean, like I'm just like, you didn't have to do that, Dad, you know. And then, you know, he leans down and he looks into the car and he says to me, he says, I meant that. And he closed the door, went into the house. And, you know, that's what I mean by rationalism. Because, you know, my parents were married in the 1932 or something like that, 1930, 1931, somewhere in there. But it was right in the middle of the Great Depression. I mean, I've heard depression stories all of my life, believe me. There's not a depression story I haven't heard. You know, you've heard them too. I mean, our parents were, that was the way our parents lived. And my dad was conservative. He was, you know, I call it conservative now. I said he was cheap when I was a kid. You know, he always had gardens, you know. We never went out to eat, you know. I mean, you know, he drove cars until they were well past the point where he should have been driving them. I mean, he just, you know, and, you know, but that's the way he was. And he had two or three jobs a lot of times. I can remember as a kid, he's just an incredibly hard worker, and he did everything that he should have done. And I'm sure they went through crisis. I mean, they had one baby that was died at childbirth, and they have all kinds of little stories to tell. And I knew life wasn't really simple, and it was hard for them. But at the end of the day, they're still together. And my mother died in my dad's arms. The hospital called when they knew she was dying because her heartbeat had accelerated to the point where they realized that death was coming closely. And so they called him up and he raced to the hospital and she died in his arms. And that's what I mean by rational. You know, that's rational relationship. They've been through hardship, but they were still together. And the realities are your organization's going to make mistakes. You're going to mess up. You're going to do things wrong sometimes. But, you know, the persons that are committed to you rationally and not just emotionally, they'll stay with you. They'll stick with you. But it's building. How do you build that kind of a relationship? And that's what development's all about, and that's what we're going to help you with. How do you build those kinds of relationships? So it's all about relationships. And the thing about that, and the reason that we talked about that to begin with, is a question that I think Arnold asked, and that is that, you know, that is something that all of us can relate to, despite where we came from. In other words, I'm not saying anything that you don't experience in Romania or Bulgaria. I mean, we all know about love. We all know about relationships. We know how important they are. And so, you know, that's the reason why I think I can travel around the world and talk about this and everybody welcomes me because, you know, despite the fact that I don't understand their culture and I don't understand how it works, you know, in a lot of ways, but the realities are I know that development, successful development is all about relationships, and that's something that everybody universally can relate to. We all know how important that is. And that's what our job is. That's what we do in development. And if that's something that just kind of lights your fire, which it does mine, because I'm a relational person. I love people. And I just want to be with them, and I want to build relationships. And if that's what you want to do, then you're in the right room. You're in the right place. And if you have a vision that's so big, you know, my friend Bill Bright said, never have a vision so small that God doesn't have to show up. If your vision is not so big that God doesn't have to, or so small that God doesn't have to show up, in other words, you could do it on your own, then just go for it and have fun. But the realities are, the reason I love working with people like you, because I like big visions. And we're going to talk about vision lightly or later. So let's go back to where we started. We're talking about the six things that made development. Fundraising, we know about that one. Recruitment, retention, we kind of know that that's really important. You know, public relations, well, people need to have a perspective of who it is we are, and hopefully it's accurate. And if it's not, and if we have high attrition, then we're not going to be successful in raising money. In other words, money is really driven by other things, isn't it? And if people have, if we could have the greatest techniques in the world, but if people are leaving in record numbers and they don't know who it is we are, and we don't really know where it is we're going, then they're not going to give to you. Now, the fourth area is database management. The fifth is strategic planning. Strategic planning. And the strategic plan just says, well, here's where we want to go. And this is what we want to look like. This is the question that I ask everybody. And so I'm going to ask you, and I'm going to ask you to kind of think about it tonight. And maybe we'll have some of you just respond to the question tomorrow morning. But here's what I'd like you to imagine. Okay? So tomorrow we're going to play make-believe, all right? We're going to make-believe that tomorrow is May 2022. Okay? Mm-hmm. We're all going to play make-believe tomorrow. Didn't you always like to play make-believe when you were a kid? We're going to kind of make-believe, okay? Tomorrow is going to be May 2022.
Do we have to look for that day?
No, you don't have to look. You don't have to dress. No, no.
Where would you and I be?
Yeah, that's right. People are going to roll Arnold and I in. Oh, yeah, here comes Arnold, yeah. And Jerry's going to come, oh, all right, you know, and I'll be drooling. And okay, so.
That picture is
just gruesome. Yeah, that's, we don't want to go there. So let's just make believe that tomorrow, tomorrow is going to be May 2022. And here's what I want you to do. And I want you to describe your organization in 2022. And here's the way I want you to, this is the question that you need to ask. If we were totally 100% successful in fulfilling the vision that God's placed in our hearts, what would our organization look like in 2022? What would Romania look like if the doctor's vision, maybe it just isn't limited to Romania, maybe it's a network of school, you know, hospitals throughout Eastern Europe and, you know, places of havens, you know, that people, you know, with illness can come and know that they're going to get, you know, competent treatment, but they're going to get it done in the love of God. You know, what's that look like? You know, what's Bulgaria going to look like, you know, if the Bible Union is totally 100% successful? What's Ukraine going to look like? And the men that you're working with, not just in Ukraine, but in other countries in Eastern Europe, what are they going to look like? You know, what a father's going to look like in 2022? What are they going to know? How are they going to be relating to their kids? How they're going to be relating to the job? How they're going to be relating to the community and their church? You know, what's Hungary going to look like if we're successful? I mean, what's it going to look like? What's Angel Wings going to look like? Now, we're not, I'll cover for you tomorrow, Patricia. But, you know, what's Angel Wings going to look like? And what's the men's ministry in Romania going to look like? And man alive, what's, you know, the two schools that you mentioned and the things that you're involved in, what are they going to look like? You know, and how's that going to impact Europe? What's Europe going to look like because of what it is that you've done? I want you to see that. And I'll spend time with boards. I spend a lot of time with boards, and that's what I usually sit down and ask them. I says, let's start with that. Let's start with thinking about what it is that we want to see happen. Because the work of development, this is where we're going to go, and I think this is what makes this session, you know, exciting. Because what we're going to do is we're going to, you know, once we have that goal kind of clearly in mind, then we're going to work backwards, okay? We're going to start doing what I call backward mapping, and we're going to say, okay, if this is where we want to go, then these are the steps that we need to take to get there. But you need a vision. There's a model that we use. I'm going to stand up. so since I've been sitting, I want the camera to go up with me, okay? But, okay. Don't worry about me. I'm totally competent. Oh, look at that. Well, what a great guy. Now I'm... That's a thought. Here's a diagram that I've used for years and I think basically describes development and the developmental function clearer than anything else that I could do. Okay? It's a pyramid, and pyramids kind of reflect, you know, architecturally, you know, a very, very stable instrument. And basically, there are four things that characterize organizations that are incredibly successful. Okay? And so the first of those is that they have, you know, a clearly stated mission. You know, they have a mission statement. Most of you have a mission statement. You've got one somewhere. And, you know, mission statements are what they are is a series of clauses that are separated by commas. Okay? You're saying this is our mission, and you describe it in short and concise terms. Now, Habitat for Humanity is one of the clients that I've worked with for years. And Habitat for Humanity has a mission statement, and this is it, okay? I'm going to give it to you. We work in partnership with people everywhere from every walk of life, comma. That's kind of a long clause. To build and renovate homes, comma. Create community, comma, so that people can become all that God intended for them to be, period. So there's four primary clauses in that mission statement. You know, that we work in partnership with God and people everywhere. So when we're doing planning, and we're going to be talking about this because it's a model that I'm going to be sharing with you later, but when we talk about planning, what we're going to do is we're going to say, you know, we're going to plan our mission statement. What would it look like, you know, if we were 100% successful, what does a partnership with God and people everywhere from every walk of life look like? In other words, if we were totally successful in fulfilling that, what does it look like? Well, I mean, you could say, you know, what does a community look like? What does the team that's building houses, what's the composition of that team? You can go to a building site for Habitat for Humanity, and on one house you'll have the President of the United States working, you know, alongside, you know, a recent, you know, arrival to the United States and a corporate president or a factory worker. They'll all be working on the same house. And that's people from every walk of life doing something together for the common good of someone else. And so the mission is very, very clear. And great organizations not only have a great mission statement, but the realities are everything that they do is driven by that mission statement. In other words, we're kind of looking at, you know, we have this activity. And sometimes what happens in organizations is we kind of start doing things that, you know, are kind of fun to do, but they don't generate any significant progress to enabling us to achieve the ultimate goal to which we've committed ourselves to. And in organizations that are really great, they look at everything after it's over and they say, okay, what did it contribute to the bottom line of what it is that we're all about as a mission, as an organization? And if it didn't work, you know, we're not going to do that anymore. Or we're going to change it. Or we're going to revise it. We're going to do something. But the realities are we can't continue to do things that are not taking us to where it is we want to go. And so every one of those clauses needs to be planned along with a lot of other things. But mission is kind of critical to the whole thing. It's the foundation upon which our organizations exist. Now, the next thing that we need to, I'm going to put a nice cloud up here. And that's the word vision. And I want to define vision as vision equals mission accomplished. In other words, and this is what I just kind of asked you to do, didn't I? I asked you to imagine what the organization would look like 10 years from now if, in fact, we accomplished this. In other words, if we got this done, you know, what does it look like up here? Don't you? I love being with visionaries. I think visionaries are just fun people to be with because they motivate me. I get challenged by visionaries. I've been challenged by and have had the opportunity of knowing some really great visionaries in the course of my life. And one of those was Bill Bright. Now, Bill Bright was the president and founder of Campus Crusade for Christ. And in 1978, Bill Bright was in a meeting. And it was kind of a meeting like this. There was just more people there. It was kind of like the prep meeting for the next year. We're kind of reflecting on what it is that God has done, and we're bringing our budgets and our plans for the next year. And now over here in the corner, there are some bean counters, you know, the accountants, the money people, you know, and they're just taking notes all along the way because they're kind of contriving a budget for next year and what it is that's going to need to happen. So these meetings, this goes on all day long. And right about where Alan is sitting is where Bill Bright was sitting, and he didn't say much during the entire meeting. He's just kind of sitting there kind of listening to everything that's going on. And so, you know, somebody says, well, this is what we want to do in Romania this year. And so, you know, the guys said this. And then this is the approximate budget. And it all goes over here. And these guys are putting it all together. Until the end of the meeting at the end of the day, which was kind of an exhausting day. And someone finally says, as the meeting's coming to a close, they says, well, Bill, do you have anything you'd like to share? And Bill stands up. Now, Bill was a big man, and he was kind of a formidable presence when he stood up in a room. And everybody kind of paid attention to him because he was Bill Bright. Plus, he just was this incredible man of God and with a great, great vision. And he says, yes. He says, I want to make sure that by the year 2000, now remember, this is like 1978, in the year 2000, that 4.5 billion people have the opportunity of seeing the Jesus film in their own language. And he sits down. I mean, there's like stone silence in the room. Like stone silence. I mean, nobody's saying anything. Except the bean counters are whispering to one another. What was the number word? Oh, Bill, question back there. Bill, you used a number. It was 4.5. What was the next word? And he says, you know, B as in billion, billion. Billion. That's everybody on planet Earth. Bill, little question over here. You know, we're just doing a little calculation over here because, you know, that's what we do. And that's like everybody on planet Earth. And Bill says, yeah, that's the way I calculate that. And does he have any idea what that will cost? Bill, one more question. Do you have any idea what that would cost? And Bill says, I ain't got a clue. Do you care, Bill? And he says, no, I don't. You know, it's something that we really need to do. Now, let me tell you something. That launched the largest single funding initiative ever launched by Campus Crusade for Christ. And it was an incredible vision. And we, you know, our organization, along with several other organizations, helped raise hundreds of millions of dollars for that project. And you know something? Rarely, rarely did we ever talk about the need. We just talked about the vision. Let me share with you a vision. Now to the credit of Bill Bright, I mean, this was not all that wild, given, you know, the history of the organization. It has done a lot of visionary things that at that time were pretty significant, but nothing that was as large as this. But we just started talking about the vision. So here's the first, you know, a little bit of tidbit of information that you ought to keep in mind now as you're beginning the process of thinking through how you do development. And here it is. Always lead with your vision and not with your need. Lead with your vision and not with your need. See, when you lead need to need, because basically if I'm coming to you with a need and I go to you and I say, is it Annie or Ann?
Yeah.
Okay, Ann. And I say, Ann, I'd like to talk to you about the need that we have in our organization. And Ann politely listens to me. She's obviously not, you know, she's a very sweet young lady, and we know that, and single, by the way. And we're looking out for you, Ann. So she listens to me. And after I'm done, she says, well, you know, Jerry, she said, you know, that's really interesting, and I, you know, it's really some great needs that you have. And but let me tell you about my needs. And all of a sudden, she's talking about her needs. And if, you know, if you put it in the crassest of terms, if my need doesn't out-trump her needs, I lose. Okay? Now, that we'd never say it that way. We'd be a little bit more delicate about it. But the realities are, you know, that that's true. That if my need doesn't out-trump your need, then the realities are, then we walk away and nothing happens. And so, but, you know, lead with your vision, because there's something emotionally, remember the role of emotion, it's emotion that brings us together, it's rationalism that keeps us together. There's something very emotional about vision. And think of the visionaries in your life. I mean, I've worked with Jim Dobson and Bill Bright and some people that, you know, are really big visionaries. And they were able, through their vision, to capture the imaginations of people that life can be different. And I think, you know, when you start talking to people, you know, about the hospital and about your vision for the hospital and your team of people that basically are joining you in this vision and you're sharing it together, you know, share the vision of what life could look like differently than what it looks like today because of what it is that you want to do. And that is, you know, what are men going to look like? You know, if we're successful in doing this, and we've got a plan to get there, but the reality is that this is what we want to see happen. And does it need to happen in our country? And you say, of course it needs to happen in our country, because fathers aren't being fathers. Men aren't being men. They're not being the leaders that they need to be. And we can do something about that, and we have a plan to get there. So lead with your vision, not with your... So vision is very, very important. Now, there's another thing that happens in an organizations that are successful, and that's represented by these steps that move from the base of the triangle up to the top of it. And within each one of these steps represents a year. So here we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years in this example, and each one of these steps has some numbers attached to it. And this is the strategic plan. In other words, we've got a plan to get there. See, when you have a vision, and I think you ought to talk about, you know, if God's laying on your heart to do a network of hospitals, you talk about the network. You know, it may be a $5 billion dream, I don't know, or whatever the case, but that's really not the point. You know, this is our vision, this is where we want to go, and we want to be here in 10 years or 7 years or 12 years or whatever the case might be. And here's, and we've got a plan, and the plan needs to make sense. You know, it's not just pie in the sky, but we've got a plan that makes sense, and it involves these 5 things, or doing these 5 or these 12 or these 16 things this year. So the defining characteristic, just keep this in the back of your mind, the defining characteristic of a strategic plan is that it's quantifiable. This is what I mean, quantifiable. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If you can't measure it, you can't assess it. Yes?
There's some thought that... our world is changing so fast that to plan beyond 3 years is almost folly because everything will change.
Right.
And so you still do the 8-year plan and you change it at the end of 2.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, I mean, the thing is that you're constantly, almost at the end of every year, you're reevaluating the circumstances and so forth. But, and you know, people do understand that. I mean, they do know that the world is changing. And I've told people that if you have a plan that you produced before 2008, then you probably ought to just, you know, let's go back and talk about it again.
But is it really worth the effort and the time to go to 8 when you know that you're going to have to discard 80% of it?
Well, let me tell you how they did it with the Jesus Film Project. Because the Jesus Film Project was really pretty interesting the way they did it. They had a great plan in place. And basically, they did little to alter it. You know, and granted, it was a period of time when things were a little bit more stable than what they are today. But it started out with, you know, if we're going to have a film that we want to produce and put it into the language of the people of the earth, you know, let's find out, you know, where the most people, the languages that the most people on earth, you know, speak. And that represents about 80% of the population of the earth speak, you know, some, you know, language. And so that was the first ones, okay? It was English and Spanish and German and French and then some dialects in Hindu that are kind of universally understood by people in India and Mandarin in China. And that was just kind of like, that's just like the obvious. Well, when we finally got up to the 22nd year, I mean, and that, this was done, you know, at the very beginning. At the 22nd year, we're translating it into dialects of people in Papua New Guinea that basically there's only 300 people in the tribe that speak this dialect. And we're translating the Jesus film into their dialect so that they can hear it for themselves. There's a point to be made there, and I think it's a very, very important one. But let me just say that if a plan lacks quantification, which is really, that's the defining characteristic of a strategic plan, that it's quantifiable. Because if it's not quantifiable, you don't have a plan at all, you have a good idea. And many of your organizations have some good ideas. It would be cool if this happened. Like, wouldn't this be neat if this happened? If the men, you know, in Romania and the men in Ukraine and other Eastern European countries, you know, if they were to, you know, develop the skills of how to be and fulfill their role in the families of which they're a part and in the communities of which they're a part, you know, think how life could change. That's a cool idea. That is just like really neat, and you could get kind of embraced by the idea. But if you don't have a plan to substantiate that this is what we're going to do this year and next year and so forth, and our ultimate goal is here, then the realities are you're going to have a hard time convincing people that they need to be investors in what it is that you're doing. So this strategic plan is very, very important. Now, there's another part of this, and then we can kind of go back and talk about it, and it's another set of stairs that goes up this side of the triangle. And they correspond with these steps, and I'm not doing a good job at that. But this is what I call the development plan. And the development plan basically is responsible, and this is what we do. This is what the role of development does. This is what you're here to learn about. The development plan basically is the plan that we have in place to provide the resources that are essential to fulfill the strategic planning initiatives. In other words, the strategic plan, you know, to translate this into Romanian is going to cost $35,000, let's say. Okay, well, that's great, you know, but in order to do it, we have to have $35,000. And so over here, you've got a team of people or an individual or whatever that basically has created a plan to make sure that the resources are available to get these things done when they need to get done. And the three resources that we basically have at our disposal, you know, if you're talking about it in the kinds of practical terms in which we find ourselves living, are what? They're people, money, and time. Those are the three resources that basically need to be planned in order to be able to achieve this. Now, people, money, and
time.
Now, this is the good news, okay? Then we can go back and talk about this. Well, I mean, there's bad news everywhere, I guess, but this is the good news. When you leave, and this is a promise I'm going to make to you. This is the thing that I'm going to share with you that hopefully will cause you to come back tomorrow. Now, Patricia wants to stay now. This sends you home. We'll keep her here. But this is the promise that I'm going to make to you. I have told people for years that if you could tell me where you wanted to go, all right, when you wanted to be there, and how much you thought it might cost in order to bring you from where it is you are to where it is you need to be, if you can tell me those three pieces of information, where you want to go, when you want to be there, and how much it's going to cost to get there, okay, then I can tell you in quantifiable terms what it is you need to do this year, next year, the years thereafter, in the kinds of ways that you can say, okay, this is what we need to do. And let me tell you something, that is a huge, huge gift to you. Because that's what we don't know. See, the problem that I had when my boss told me, you know, what do I do? Raise money. How much? A lot. Hey, you're not helping. This isn't helping at all. I mean, I know you're being facetious at one level, but you're not helping me. And the reason why we get so exasperated with this profession is because most of us walk into the office saying, well, what are we going to do today about development? I guess I've got to do something. What am I going to do today? So we're kind of trying, well, I guess I'll do this or I guess I'll do that or whatever. And how do you know if you're ever successful? Because everybody's saying you need more, you need more, you need more. That's not enough. That's not enough. That's not enough. And you're saying, hey, stop, hold it. And so what I'm going to share on the last day we're together, on Wednesday, I'm going to give you some formulas that, believe me, if somebody had given to them to me, if I had known about this 30 years ago, I would have given my right arm to get this information. I mean, literally, I would have. I mean, it basically, nobody knew. I mean, and you go to people. Isn't it frustrating in this profession? You go to somebody and says, well, you know, could you help me? I'm dealing with this problem. And people look like deer that have just, you know, saw a car coming, you know. And what? I don't know anything about that. You know, go talk to somebody, you know, that I don't know. I mean, you, who do you go to in this profession? You know, if you want to get an answer, I mean, the people that hire you don't know what they do. They just wanted to hire you so that they could, I call it pilot's basin. Now we're just going to kind of wash our hands of this thing and kind of hope that everything works out in the end. And if you feel that way, then it's justifiable. You're saying, well, it's wrong. I don't want to feel that way because I really love these people. But essentially, you've got to know that you're making a difference. And you have to define success. And you have to, and one of the things that I'm going to share with you before you leave is this. You need to go back to the people that you're working with, you know, and you need to create a developmental plan, and you need to get them to sign off on it. You need to define success, because if you don't define success, somebody else will. And you will never achieve it. So you need to define success. And you're going to say, well, this is what we're going to do. This is our plan. This is a step. Anybody got any questions about that? You know, what do you think? Is this going to work? And you know, get them to sign off on it and say, okay, now we're going to pursue it. And hold yourself accountable to what it is you just told me you were going to do. You know, send them, you know, quarterly reports that basically show the progress that you're making, and make them partners with you rather than, you know, critics of you, and helping you together to do what it is that needs to be done to build the infrastructure that's going to be sufficient in strength to be able to take us from where it is we are to where it is we want to go. And see, what you're doing is you're not only raising money, you're building infrastructure to support the future. And we've got to think bigger than just the fact that we've got an annual need. The fact is that, yeah, we have an annual need, but we have a goal beyond our annual need, and that's what we've got to build structure for. And just trying to repeat every year what it is we're doing just to survive, to provide the money that we need to survive, and that's usually the way most development programs work. I've just got to raise enough money so that we can continue to operate next year. That's what we got to do. So everybody just works really hard. You know, you get to the end of the year, I hate it. You know, so you take one good night's sleep, and then you go back and start it all over the next year. And how long are you going to do that? I mean, how long are you just going to... I mean, let's be realistic. How long are you willing to do that? Probably not very long. But, you know, I just think we just really must do this. And I think I can really help you in that. Now, here's some of the bad news, okay? The good news is this works, and we're going to kind of work through every step of this process, you know, while we're here together, and it's going to be fun. You're going to really enjoy it, okay? 98% of all the organizations in the world that are kind of what it is that you do, they all have a mission statement. So that's the good news. Isn't that great? 98%. 2% don't. You say, well, who doesn't? Well, churches don't normally have a mission statement. And you say, and if you ask them, do you have a mission statement? And you know what their response is? We're a church, duh. You know? I mean, figure it out. We're a church. You know? Well, not every church is the same. You know, churches have unique missions and so forth, and I think it's very, very important that they understand, you know, the role that they're fulfilling in equipping and training people for works of ministry. That is our ultimate goal as church leaders, is to equip and train people for works of ministry and then strategically deploy them into the world as salt and light. That's what we do. But how do you do it? That's the mission. How you go about fulfilling the commandment and the mandate that is basically given to the church. Now, vision statements. 56% of organizations have a written vision statement. What it is that I'm asking you essentially to think about tonight. 56%. Now, some of them have ideas, you know, and they, yeah, well, this is kind of like what we think we ought to look like. This would be really cool if we got to here, you know, but it's just kind of, you know, a great idea that basically may or may not happen. So 56%. Now it gets really interesting. 12% of organizations like yours have a functional strategic plan, which is serving as a roadmap to that organization. In other words, they know where they are on the journey at any given time, and they have created a map that basically, again, you know, the destination remains the same. You know, maybe the route's going to change because of circumstances and economies and things of that nature, but technology, which basically enables us to accelerate what it is that we can do that we were never able to do, you know, 20 years ago. When I started in development almost 40 years ago, you know what a database was? 3x5 cards in a shoebox. Only Arnold and I remember that. 3x5 cards in a shoebox. That's what it was. We had a big shoebox with 3x5 cards in it. It had it alphabetically ordered, and some of you are saying, yeah, what's different? You know, what's changed? But the reality is that's what it was.
But I had a card that had niches on the top, little Vs.
Huh?
But some of them were still in there. And I could stick a long, thin needle in there, and that's the way I could separate out the people that I wanted. This, I just stick that needle.
Look at that.
It's advanced technology.
That is. Yeah, see? Victor, you gotta, yeah, get that. You know, put a hole.
Filters now. Criteria you set up.
Yeah, right. It's just, yeah, but Arnold was so far ahead of time. You were a man ahead of your time.
Oh, this is in the
50s. Yeah, right. Oh, my gracious. So that's the way it was. But, you know, today we can just do things so much quicker and so much more. I mean, just communication alone. We're doing a lot of things in texting in America where we have, you know, kind of a unique capability to do that in our country, which may not exist in yours. I don't know. But, just some unbelievable stuff. I mean, even our small group. I have a small group that I lead in my church. And every day at 11:05, you know, I get a message. It's a text message. And it's a text message that has a Bible verse. And then there's a question after it. And then there's a person in my group, that's my small group, and I pray for that person that day. Every day I get it, 7 days a week, 31 days a month. You know, and it just kind of comes every day at 11:03. I know what it is. And it's a way to keep our group together. And so it's that kind of communication capabilities that we had that we didn't have before. You know, our company that I work with just, you know, invested in an instrument that's called, you can go to the website, it's called boxcast.net, or com, boxcast, boxcast.com. And it's an instrument that costs about $1,000. It's got two ports on it. One says video in. You take a coaxial cable, video in. There's another one that has video out, video out, and you're ready to go. No software, nothing else. You can video stream immediately, live. What does that mean? Well, we've got Christian high schools in America that are video streaming classes live, that are going to cities in smaller towns and communities throughout their area that are too small to be able to have a Christian school, and they're sitting live in a classroom. And it's free. I mean, the reality is this is just video streaming over high-speed internet lines. You know, before, if we ever wanted to do that, we had to have a satellite, didn't we? We had to, you know, buy some space on a satellite, and then you had to buy something on the other end to be able to retrieve the message. And it was extremely expensive, and nobody did it. Now we can do it. We can set up an organization in 20 minutes, and they could be video streaming live. It video streams live, and then 5 minutes after it's over, it tapes it all and puts it in the storage bin, and you can put it on your website, and people can go back and listen to it again. And I believe that God has given us the capability now, in this generation, to reach another generation more. I mean, you can video stream, you know, training programs in Kyiv to every city, you know, simultaneously, immediately, every city in Ukraine and Eastern Europe, live. It doesn't cost anything. I mean, stop and think about that. Just get your arms around that. I mean, talk about what it is that you're talking about educationally. You know, I'm basically being a proponent in America right now of establishing a network of 1,200 in America, 1,200 Christian community colleges. Now, stop and think about that. Now, maybe it's not like a big deal here as it is in America, but in America, it costs students anywhere $25,000 to $40,000 a year to go to a private Christian college. And a lot of these kids are graduating with debt, you know, like $60,000 and $70,000 of debt. And now, given the state of the economy, parents are saying, no way. I mean, a private Christian educational experience is basically not even on their radar screen anymore. They're not even talking about it because we can't afford it. We can't. I'm not going to let my kid graduate with $70,000 in debt and then marry somebody from the same college with $70,000 in debt. That equals $140,000, and there's not an 18-year-old or 22-year-old in the world that knows what $120,000 of debt looks like and what that's going to mean to their life and their ability to be able to have a family and to have a house and to have all the things that they really want in establishing themselves. And so basically there's this huge need out there, and there wasn't a Christian, you know, up to last year, there wasn't, to my knowledge, a Christian community college, you know, in the United States. Now we're seeing a lot of colleges that are doing, you know, basically providing these opportunities, and instead of charging $1,200 and $1,400 an hour, charging $300 an hour. And basically providing an opportunity for families who basically had never even dreamt of a college, Christian college education, giving them the opportunity to be able to get it affordably. That's the kind of world that we live in. We can do that now. I mean, you know, rather than a teacher, and well, we can talk about some things. How much time do we have left, Troy?
5 minutes.
Okay, you didn't put it up yet.
I was just ordering.
Would you do it for me so that everybody can see it? All right, everybody look. See, look at isn't that incredible? Troy is so good, you know, and we need to acknowledge Troy when we leave. Pat him on the back before, because you know he's our room daddy, you know. So, okay, so. I wrote a book just recently. It's entitled "You Snooze, You Lose," and the subtitle of the book is "Adapting to the New Economy." And essentially, the conclusion of the book is this. This is where I took the book. The conclusion of the book is this: that the economic situation that we find ourselves, and it's not just in America; it's around the world. I mean, all of you. I mean, good night. You don't. I mean, it's probably more preponderance of information being sent from Europe in relationship to, you know, the crisis in Greece, and it's exacerbated by a crisis in Italy and in Spain. And I mean, all of us are facing economic crisis. And so things have changed. That people are looking at life a whole lot differently today than they were looking at life, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. So my point of the book is that the new, you know, the economic crisis is really the new economy. Let's get settled. You know, let's brace ourselves. This is the way it's going to be for a while. It's not going to change. And I'm not pessimistic, as you can gather. I'm about the most optimistic person you'll ever meet in your life. I mean, I just think I've never seen a half full glass of anything. I mean, I just see, you know, it's three quarters full or a quarter full or whatever the case might be. But I am a pragmatist. I've been doing this for 40 years. But the point of the title is this: you snooze, you lose. If you go to bed tonight thinking that I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning and everything's going to be all better, you're going to lose. This is our hour of opportunity, and that's why I'm so excited about, you know, our time together. This is why I'm traveling everywhere that I can go, and I'm talking to anybody that will listen to me, because I think God has given to us on the silver platter the opportunity to change the world and to reach a generation for Jesus Christ. And by golly, I'm not going to retire. I want to make sure that these shoes are warm when I die. That they're still hot, because we're going to finish the race, and Arnold and I are going to race to the finish line. I just promise you we're going to do that, because we must do it. And you know who God's going to use to do it? It's people like you and me.
I want to shoot, Jerry.
Go and figure.
Before you go.
Yeah, go and figure. I mean, God's going to use people like you and me. And you say, hold it. Do you know who I am? Yeah, God knows who you are, and that's why he's going to use you, because God has always used the most unlikely people in all the world to do the most incredible things that have ever happened in this world, because they trusted and they believed in God. And if we could do it by ourselves, you know, why would we even bother? I mean, because the reality is none of us are capable of doing it. I can't do it. You know, come on, Alan. You gotta be kidding. You can't do that. That's right, I can't. But God put it in your heart to do it, and he can give you the power to do it and the strength to do it. And at the end of the day, you can't say, look what I did, any more than Gideon could, you know. Well, look, we got cut of these Amalekites. We had just 300 guys, and they had like 13,000. You know, hey, look what we, you know, that's the Rocky Balboa. Hey, Adrian, look what we did. Okay, so anyway, I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for coming. It's going to get better. This was kind of slow today, but we're going to pick it up tomorrow, and it's going to get better. And by the time that you leave on Wednesday, they'll be dancing in the street. Okay. You're going to miss that, aren't you, Patricia, the dancing in the street part? Alan, you had a question.
Yes, sir. You said
how many? What is the percentage on the development plan? 3.6. Now, is there any reason why? Are you having a hard time figuring out why we're losing so many nonprofits? I mean, just look at that. Look at those statistics. You know, and if you want to put in the statistics for yourself, I mean, we got that. What about the mission? Well, I'm not sure that we've got an articulated vision statement. Do you have a strategic plan? Well, we've got some good ideas. Do we have a development plan? 90% of you would say, or 97% would say, no, we don't have a development plan. We never even thought about that before. And then what's the likelihood of your success given those percentages? And you say, well, probably about a 90% likelihood that we won't succeed. That's probably true. But if we do it right, what's the likelihood of success? And I think it increases exponentially, and especially when you add the God component, because none of this is possible without the power of God.